Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you. And then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Springfield, Illinois, and earned a bachelor's degree in diplomacy and world affairs from Occidental College, and a master's degree in law and diplomacy from Tufts University. For 30 years, she served in the U.S. Navy, eventually achieving the rank of Rear Admiral, then was the executive director of the Girl Scouts of the USA, then the CEO of the American Red Cross, and then the interim commissioner of the Ladies Professional Golf Association. Unbelievable. Her name? Rear Admiral Marsha Marty Evans. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a lady this evening that's a one in a billion resume and a one in a billion lady. Rear Admiral Marsha Marty Evans. Marty, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, it's terrific to be with you. I've admired what you're doing and the whole concept of your show, so I'm delighted to be with you.
All right, let's go back to Springfield, Illinois, the capital of Illinois. Talk about your childhood and your mom and your dad.
My parents grew up in Springfield. They were high school sweethearts. And then my dad went off to World War II. So he was a sailor on a ship out in the South Pacific. So when he came back, they married, and I was the firstborn. My dad then used the GI Bill to go to college down in South Texas. And while he was in college, the Korean War broke out. And he felt he had a calling to be in the military. So off he went. And that really began our lives of traveling around not only the U.S., but also overseas. So I grew up as a Navy brat. He stayed in the Navy to finish 22 years and was in California when he retired. And that's where I ended up going to college. But along the way, we lived for 4 years in French Morocco. It became Morocco while we were there. And I would say that probably those years from 7 to 11 years old, that got me interested in international things. I sort of knew the Navy life because, we were living it. And when I got ready to go to college, I studied international relations, diplomacy, and world affairs. When I was in my senior year in college, I was going to graduate school. But one day, in Easter weekend of 1968, I saw a picture of a woman naval officer in the newspaper. And I had a fantasy about the Navy. And kind of the rest is history. I joined in a couple of weeks. My father tried to talk me out of it because he was convinced I would be a really good college professor, which had been my overarching career goal. But they signed the papers. I wasn't yet 21. And off I went to officer training. And I asked my dad if he missed the Navy. And he said only 1,000 times a day. So I knew it was good for him, and it turned out to be me.
All right. And also, I believe in 68, you worked in the Nixon White House and then later in the Ford White House. Talk about that chapter of your life.
Well, I actually, my first assignment was Washington, D.C., and then my second assignment was Japan. So I went off to Japan, and by now I'm in the Navy 4 years, come back to Washington in 1972. And I was invited to be a White House social aide. And that was a really fun assignment. It was kind of an extra duty assignment. And whenever the president and the first lady would have any kind of function, whether it was a state dinner or a treaty signing ceremony or a reception, one or more of us, there were 26 of us from all the different services, we would assist the president and or first lady. So I was there for the last year of the Nixon administration. I was there right up to the very end of that just unimaginable situation with his resignation. And then I stayed on for the first year of the Ford administration. So I had a chance to see the transition of government. You know, we had never really been through anything like that as a country. And I can say it convinced me that our whole system of government was alive and well. And I really admired President Ford.
You saw a lot of famous people come through there for these dinners, et cetera. Was there one, Marty, that you said, wow?
You know, there were some that I couldn't believe I was in their presence. One in particular was Fred Astaire. He was a dinner guest one night. And of course, I'm 5'11" tall. He was about 5'2" at that point. He was rather elderly. So that was kind of a shock. But he was so gracious. He danced with one of my colleagues, the woman Marine socially. And it was just absolutely thrilling. I'll tell you, though, from my perspective, the chance to be with President Ford, who at the time was the Speaker of the House, I guess, and to have him become the Vice President. I was with him. I was escorting him and Mrs. Ford that night. And to have him become the Vice President and then to have him become the President, it was absolutely thrilling to be there with them. Another luminary was Henry Kissinger. He was, of course, the National Security Advisor at the time. And he was, from my academic studies, he was an icon in my mind. So it was an otherworldly existence. And I would say, Jack, that I would pinch myself every time I went through the gates of the White House because I was the daughter of a Navy sailor. I went to college on a scholarship. I worked a couple of jobs while I was in college. And here I am now at the White House, and I was about, 26 years old. So anything is possible, and it was pretty exciting. It was happening to me.
We're talking to Rear Admiral Marty Evans. When we come back, we're going to ask her about her 30-year chapter in the U.S. Navy. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul. And you've heard the term often, Jack of all trades, master of none. Well, our guest tonight is a master of all trades and a jack of none. First person I've ever met like that. So, Marty, 30 years in the Navy, 1968 to 1998. Talk about those 30 years, please.
Those 30 years really spanned several eras in the Navy. In 1968, when I joined, women in the Navy were called WAVES, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, which was the name adopted in World War II. And we were a very small number. There were about 500 women officers. And we did a lot of administrative training, public relations, protocol kinds of duties. In the 1970s, when the draft ended, the military services decided that they should take in more women because they were actually turning away women, and without the draft, they would still have to fill the ranks. So women were embraced in all the military services, and new assignments, new jobs were opened that women hadn't served in before. And I was the beneficiary of that. I was in a number of jobs where I was the first woman to be assigned there. And then later in my career in the 90s, early 90s, of course, the combat exclusion law was ended. And so women had the opportunity and were assigned now to Navy ships. They were assigned to aircraft carriers, destroyers. They were assigned to fly combat jets on and off those aircraft carriers. And so I had the opportunity to be part of that transition through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and to relish the opportunities that young women had to do things that they never imagined being able to do, and to be accepted as full shipmates, as full team members. And for me, that really was a very important part of my military career, to feel like I was on the team, I was pulling my fair share of the load, and I was respected by my colleagues.
I was honored to twice fly out to the U.S. Naval, Teddy Roosevelt, the big stick. 97,000 tons, goes 34 and a half miles an hour. It's the size or equal to the height of a 24-story building. The landing area is about 750 feet compared to 10,000 feet at an airport. There were 5,700 kids on that aircraft carrier. Average age, Marty, was 19 and a half. They're landing these $120 million jets going 140 miles an hour, where they snag a steel wire and stop in 315 feet in the middle of the night. Talk about the job these young kids do on these aircraft carriers.
You know, Jack, you just described what the military, what the Navy is all about. It's taking that young person, male or female, who hopefully has graduated from high school, maybe had a little college or a little work experience, and mold them into a very responsible, caring, patriotic young man or woman who can be given an assignment and can be trusted to carry out that assignment. And as you alluded to, we're talking about the lives of their fellow sailors and officers. There's no margin for error. There's no opportunity to kind of kick back and not pay attention to detail. And I think that's what the military offers a young person. It's the opportunity to enter an organization with some structure, with leadership, with caring, experienced people who provide guidance, who provide training. In my experience in the military, one of the most critical tasks of a leader is to prepare the next generation of leaders. And so in the Navy, you spend an awful lot of time mentoring, helping, instructing that young person so that he or she can be counted on. And in peacetime, you know, counted on fine to do the job. But, you know, at the pointy end of the spear, when our troops are deployed overseas, when that aircraft carrier is operating off the coast of China or in the Middle East, those young people, a 19 and a half year old on average, is out there doing heroic work on a day-to-day basis. It's not 8 to 5, it's 24/7. And it makes me proud of what the Navy can do for our country. At the end of their enlistment, they may not stay in the Navy for 4 or 6 more years, or they may, but if they go back to their civilian community, they're going to be a real asset to that community too.
You eventually rose to the rank of Rear Admiral. I think when you left, there were only two female Rear Admirals in the Navy. Mm-hmm. Was your dad still alive, and what did he say about you?
My father had the opportunity to come to Washington on a day in the spring of, it was about 1992, the spring of, not, I'm sorry, 1993. And he came to the Pentagon and had the opportunity to witness the Chief of Naval Operations promoting his daughter to one-star admiral. Well, I was afraid he was going to pass out. He was so overwhelmed. I reminded him that day that he had counseled me not to go into the Navy because I was tracking to be a college professor. And of course, he forgot that. But he was my great inspiration, and I was so pleased that he lived long enough to see me in the Chief of Naval Operations office being promoted.
We're talking to Rear Admiral Marsha Marty Evans, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Rear Admiral Marsha Marty Evans. A great question for Jeopardy could be, what do the Nixon White House, the U.S. Navy, American Red Cross, Girl Scouts, LPGA all have in common? And the answer would be, they're all better because of Marty Evans. So, Marty, speaking of young people, young women, from 1998 to 2002, you're executive director of the Girl Scouts of America.
Yes.
Talk about that chapter.
You know, while I was in the Navy and in my later years, I was the chief recruiter for the Navy from 1993 to 1995. And I have to say that I was always disappointed when I talked to young women in high school who weren't interested in science and math, who weren't interested in doing something non-traditional. And it struck me that one of the reasons was because they had never been mentored and coached to take a chance, to see the possibilities and go for it. And so when I was approached about retiring from the Navy and becoming the CEO of the Girl Scouts, I couldn't imagine a better place to help girls from daisies at 5 years old, 7 year old brownies, and so on, to develop confidence, to develop wider horizons, to maybe focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math subjects. Or, this was very important to me, to become more physically fit, to do sports, to get outside and move. Because I saw young women who weren't qualified to join the military because they were not fit or had issues like that. So I saw the Girl Scouts as an opportunity for every girl in America, as the founder said, for every girl in America to have a chance at better opportunities. When I joined the Girl Scouts in 1998, it was clear we weren't reaching girls as far and wide as we should be. In the inner city, in the very rural areas, girls whose mothers were in prison, so the mothers couldn't be Girl Scout volunteers. So it was a great opportunity to look at how we could extend the reach of Girl Scouts and give more girls the opportunity to get a good start in life.
You spoke about self-confidence. If we could give every young person and every young lady true self-confidence, so many of these problems would go away. If there's a mom or dad tonight listening saying, Marty, how do I give my 13-year-old daughter self-confidence? What do you say to him or her?
Well, I think that helping girls engage with caring adults in settings like the Girl Scouts or settings like the First Tee, that's a golf organization that I'm involved with today. But getting that young woman or young man into some kind of a structured learning experience, whether it's Boy Scouts or whatever, so that they have a chance to explore new topics, to have new experiences, to have some successes, maybe even have some competition. And I think that's one of the great things about youth sports is the opportunity to compete and to support, to be on a team. When I was stationed at the Naval Academy, we looked at the success rate of midshipmen, and we found that those midshipmen, whether they were male or female, who were on sports teams, tended to be more successful at the academy. So I think it's really important. I think also, depending on what the family's religious affiliation, there are opportunities through church or synagogue or some kind of other young person's organization that offers some character development as well.
All right. Then from 2002 to 2005, you were the CEO of the American Red Cross. First off, did you ever give blood to the Red Cross before you became the CEO?
I sure did. I was a blood donor for sure.
All right. Tell us about the Red Cross.
You know, the Red Cross is an amazing organization, not only here in the U.S., but the American Red Cross works with partner Red Cross and Red Crescent organizations around the world to alleviate suffering. I mean, if you think about the number of disasters, just here in the U.S., 60,000 disasters a year, whether it's a single family house fire or a hurricane or almost unimaginable disaster like 9/11. So the Red Cross, the vast majority of services and support provided by the Red Cross, it's all done by volunteers. And that's the miracle of it, whether it's the blood donation, those are all volunteer blood donors, or it's people who are working in disaster shelters, people who are distributing food in a food line with a disaster, all volunteers by and large. So I think it's an opportunity for Americans to come together, and you'd be surprised at how many people we have from other countries who come and lend a hand on Red Cross disasters. Canadians were huge supporters in the hurricanes in the mid-2000s. The Red Cross is really just a remarkable organization, and I think the country is extremely fortunate to have such an organization available in times of need. And, you know, I have to say the Red Cross needs America's support too, because the financial donations are extremely important to carrying out the mission.
Speaking of hurricanes, let's go back 15 years, August 29th, 2005, New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina. Please.
I was on my way to China. I was in Los Angeles Airport. I was going to represent the American Red Cross in the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Red Cross. And I looked on the TV in the boarding area for my flight to China, and I saw the latest update. I did not go to China. I raced back to Washington. And, you know, I would say that the good news was that we had so much support from the American public to provide the disaster relief. I would also say that because it was larger than anything, anybody, whether it was FEMA or the National Guard or Homeland Security, it was larger than anybody ever imagined, required more support for the people that were affected by it in so many different states, that we learned a huge amount about disaster relief. Unquestionably, the whole system could have been better, but I think the reason that so many people were helped in the wake of Katrina was because there was just such an outpouring of support. You know, the hurricanes before Katrina, we had never had one that was even half as big. So it was just almost inconceivable.
All right. You talked about a plane ride. Let's pretend we were all flying again. And you're on a plane from Florida to Chicago. And you're sitting next to somebody and you start to talk. And the person next to you says, "Well, Marty, tell me about you." Okay. What would you say?
What would I say? I would say that I am the greatest beneficiary of America you could ever imagine. I was lucky enough to be born in a family with a loving mother and father. I was lucky enough that I traveled as a young person, so I was exposed to new settings, diversity, and foreign countries. But then I was lucky enough to have the opportunity for scholarships to go to college. I had a great high school and counselors who encouraged me. I went to college. I had great mentors. Accidentally saw a picture of a woman officer in the newspaper, and that led me to a 30-year career in the Navy. I had amazing bosses in the Navy. I was on a team where in every duty station I had, I was on a team where my contribution mattered, and I was able to be supported by my bosses, by my shipmates, my teammates. And then, you know, the opportunities that came my way. I would say to anybody that be open to the possibilities. You don't know how things are going to unfold in front of you. Take a chance. Don't just do the conventional thing, but if you see an opportunity there, you know, get some advice, consider it carefully, but don't be afraid to take that step. I mean, I was not a golfer when I became the head of the LPGA, the Ladies Professional Golf Association, but the skills that I had developed along the way helped me make a contribution to that organization. So the bottom line is I'm the luckiest person in the world, I think.
We're talking to Rear Admiral Marty Evans. And as she mentioned, in 2009, she became the interim commissioner of the LPGA. When we come back, we're going to ask her how that ever came to be. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoholm. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Rear Admiral Marty Evans. 30 years in the U.S. Navy, one of only two women to be Rear Admirals. Then she ran the Girl Scouts of the USA. Then she was the CEO of the American Red Cross. And one day, she decides to become the interim commissioner of the LPGA, the Ladies Professional Golf Association. How?
Well, I ask myself that too.
Why?
Sometimes.
And what?
Jack, I mentioned that I thought it was very important that girls have the opportunity to do sports. So while I was at Girl Scouts, we signed a partnership with the Ladies Professional Golf Association for the LPGA teaching pros to give lessons to girls in Girl Scouts. And we were specifically focusing on girls who would never in a million years have the opportunity to see a golf course, much less play golf. And so I went and I watched some teaching pros in Chicago work with some girls that had come from the inner city in a Girl Scout experience. And it was magic. These girls, I mean, they were so enthralled with the idea of being a professional sports person. So I was hooked on golf because I saw this interaction. And so my husband and I started going to the LPGA tournaments. And we had a blast. My husband happens to be a really good golfer, but I had never played the game. We enjoyed it so much. So I was asked to join an advisory board to the LPGA, and then subsequently was asked to be on the board of the LPGA. So I was on the board. And we had a sudden a departure of the CEO. And, you know, it was kind of one of those situations where we sat in a room and said, well, who's going to become the CEO until we can do a full recruitment process? And they said, well, you've been a CEO, Marty, so could you be the CEO of the LPGA? And I said, well, with a lot of help from all of you. So there again, you know, I had the opportunity, but I had so much support. The players were terrific. And the players like Annika Sorenstam, I mean, she was, you know, at the height of her career at the time. And the players had such good advice for me about the organization. So it was a great 7 month period. And, you know, anytime you, you have to go to a golf course for your place of work, it's a pretty good day.
Speaking of Annika, I think there's only been 17 pros to ever shoot 59. She's the only lady to do it. She once played in a men's tournament. Mm-hmm. How good are these ladies of the LPGA today?
They are amazing. They're absolutely terrific. And if you look at their swings, they have such beautiful swings. They just the mechanics, the physics of it, you know, they in some cases 5 feet five, 5 feet eight, not very tall in stature, but I'll tell you what, they can really hit the ball. But I think the point that a lot of people don't know about women golfers in the LPGA is they do charity tournaments, they do workshops and demonstrations. They coach and mentor young people, even players like Nancy Lopez, who, you know, Hall of Famer. She comes back to the LPGA when they have orientation for the rookies, and she helps to orient the rookies. So she's giving back even at this stage of her career. I don't think there are any finer women than the women who are competitors on the LPGA, but then also spend an awful lot of their time in charity, different kinds of charity work.
Your whole life is one exercise of courage after another, taking on jobs that you don't have the experience for, yet you jump into it. Talk to us about courage.
I guess I've never thought of it as particularly courageous. I've thought of it as going into a situation where there are inevitably some challenges. But in no case have I gone to a job where there haven't been competent, very competent, dedicated people on the team. And I think one of the key focuses for me, my approach, has been to figure out how I can capitalize on the talent that is already there. People generally have really good ideas and they have solutions to problems. And it's the task of a leader, I think, to help bring all of that to the fore, to help people give their all, to remove the barriers to their success. I've been an adherent of a school of leadership called servant leadership, where I think my number one job is to serve the people that I'm leading. And it's been remarkable that they give their best and we manage to succeed. And I think people are generally the same. They want to be given the opportunities. They want to be rewarded, coached, mentored, and they'll perform for in whatever setting. So a mentor of mine once said, when I asked her, I said, well, how do you take on these jobs that you've not had the right experience for and so on? And she said, well, you know, the first time I did it was a little scary. The second time it wasn't so scary. The third time, oh, I knew I could do it. So I just did it. And I think that's good advice. You know, don't focus on the scariness of it, but just focus on what you've got to get done. What's the mission? What are the goals? What are you trying to accomplish? Help people understand that so they can lend their best hand.
All right, let's talk about this COVID pandemic, the new normal. What are the positives from this COVID crisis, and what are the opportunities, Marty?
I think sometimes it's hard to think about the positives, but I would say that if you had another point in time or another, what now, are we into the 6 months, 7 months now, there has never been more creative thinking about how we're going to get the job done, whether it's develop a vaccine, whether it's deal with the incredible medical challenges, whether it's figuring out how to work from home, Zoom, who knew Zoom 6 months ago, not many people. How to come together as communities, how to make sure that people who need help that are homebound get the help. So I think one of the things that's come out of this is an incredible amount of creativity, making it up on the run, figuring out what's going to work and what isn't, and doing it very, very quickly. I think the challenge, well, we know the challenges. I mean, we've got to get a vaccine. And, you know, I think the people who are participating in the trials, I think that's really important. I'm in one of the vaccine trials because I think if you can meet the qualifications, it's important to do it because we've got to get a vaccine quickly. And there are so many candidates that, you know, certainly some of them are going to be successful, and we want to accelerate that process. But I mean, this is a time where it's just been so important for people to come together in any way they possibly can, whether it's calling people on the phone or gathering on driveways with social distancing and masks, just to check up on each other to make sure everybody's as okay as we can possibly be.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice do you give to our young listeners, please?
Well, a couple of things. I would say one is when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So, you know, you're going to be faced with challenges in your life. Sometimes the biggest hurdle is just to get your mind around the fact that you've got to start solving the problem. I was given a challenge in the Navy once, and my first instinct was, oh, why me? Why do I have to solve that problem? Well, I was the biggest impediment to getting on with solving the problem. So I would say, go for it, tackle the tough problems, never be afraid to step out and do something different, never be afraid to step out and do the right thing. I think it's very important for young people today to be coached and mentored to do the right thing, because at some point in their lives, they're going to have a tough ethical challenge. And you can't start too young to begin building the ethical muscles so you can make the right choice when that comes along. So that's my advice.
Rear Admiral Marsha Marty Evans, you're a Hall of Famer in achievements, but even more so, better than that, as far as being classy and humble. Thanks for all you do every day. Keep it up.
Thank you, Jack. I really enjoyed being with you tonight.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohon.
Believe in yourself.